This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight. Join host Mila Atmos this week as she talks with Alec Karkatsanis, founder of the nonprofit Civil Rights Corps and author of Unusual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System, available wherever you get your podcasts or at futurehindsight.com. And now for this show.
Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 18th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Biden signs law for a new federal holiday. So happy Juneteenth. Today, new federal holiday. Meanwhile, the ACA survives yet another and maybe the last Supreme Court challenge. Supreme Court also happens to rule that U.S. corporations have no responsibility for the child slave labor that is used by their foreign suppliers. Supreme Court also finds that taxpayer-funded foster agencies can discriminate against LGBTQ parents if the agency is religious. House votes to end the 2002 authorization of use of military force. That's the one for Iraq. The 2001 AUMF still exists. Meanwhile, looking towards the infrastructure bill, Sanders is now pushing a $6 trillion infrastructure bill as a way of resenting where the center is from those gang of 10 driving that number down. Western heat wave breaking records. Meanwhile, NASA issues a report the Earth is now trapping an unprecedented amount of heat. MSNBC refuses to voluntarily recognize their newsroom union effort. Joe Manchin intros a revamped voting bill, and Mitch McConnell says, "D's nuts." All this and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I really said that, huh?
What's that? The
D's nuts?
Yeah, that's it. I think McConnell is wanted to be hip, I guess.
And he's kind of like
D's nuts.
D's nuts.
Yes. So there is that. We will get to that. We're going to talk about that audio tape that came out the other day about Joe Manchin. Just, I think it's one of the most fascinating living documents. Well, it's not a living document, but documents in terms of our modern political system and also the politics of the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we should give credit to it. Didn't just come out. It was, you know, Lee Fong and Ryan Grimm.
I indeed. Yeah. It was not. It was. They somehow got a hold of it and. Boy, I'd like to know how they did that. But obviously, joining me is Emma Vigeland, as she does every day. Emma, hello. How are you?
Hello. I'm well. How are you?
In fact, some days, I don't even join you.
I know. Look at that, right? I mean, how's everyone been enjoying my hosting? Thank you.
There you go.
I felt the love through the
Yeah, folks, we're pretty excited.
5G that's now in me, right?
Exactly.
It allows me to telepathically communicate with the audience.
Yes, that's why.
Thank you, Pfizer. No need
to articulate that, folks, because just send your good vibes. And fortunately, Emma's vaxxed, and so she picks up on them.
Yes. I just have to go like this, and we're all set.
Speaking of meta things, we should just address this. It was announced the other day that editorial workers at MSNBC and The Choice, which is the MSNBC, I don't know what the structure is necessarily, but it's the MSNBC network on the Peacock app.
Right.
And it's not actually MSNBC, it's The Choice. And this show is licensed to The Choice, The Majority Report. And then we have a second show, which we call Reported, because we interview reporters primarily, Emma and I do, which is a second show that plays on there. And we also license that show to The Choice. And so they don't actually produce our shows. I honestly don't know. We also, I think it's probably hard for people to believe this, but we don't script our programs.
We do not.
I know that must be shocking to people. I wasn't just adding the stuttering as a way of making seem like the words were my own.
That's just me trying to hit a page count that Sam makes me hit. So I just put a lot of ums and ahs in there.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
There's a character threshold.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say those margins are pretty big, Matt. Anyways. But I just wanted to do that for full disclosure because, obviously this is a story in the news. There have been other newsrooms that have unionized under the Writers Guild of America East. There are two separate entities, the Writers Guild of America West and the Writers Guild of America East. And ABC News, Bustle, CBS News, Fast Company, HuffPost, The Intercept, Salon, Slate, Vice, Vox.
Condé Nast this week.
Oh, Condé Nast this week, right?
Yeah.
Did they do
after a 2-year fight? I mean, they went and
was that the New Yorker magazine as well?
Yes. Okay. They went outside. You know, what's her name? Anna Wintour's home. All that kind of stuff. It was a long fight for them.
Gizmodo Media Group and Hearst magazines. So this is happening, and so it is in the news. And it was our responsibility to let you know that we have a relationship, even though, arguably at arm's length. I don't know how this will impact us. At one point, we'll get a guest on to talk about that. I can tell you that my personal opinion is that I am completely in favor of unionization. MSNBC put out a statement. The president of MSNBC put out a statement to the New York Times, put out by Rashida Jones. She's the president of MSNBC. She wrote, we're looking forward to continuing the type of direct, open, and honest communication that has already resulted in meaningful change at the network. Here's the statement. And she says, I respect our employees' right to decide whether they want to be represented by a union, and I believe our employees should be able to make such an important decision through a standard election process. Now, I don't know what the standard part of this means. It's an election process. There are two different ways that a union, that a shop can get unionized. And one is where you have the people who work there articulate that they want to have a union. There was a lot of names on that list.
Yeah.
And I'll be totally honest. I don't have a sense of how many of that editorial staff, what percentage they represent of the editorial staff of MSNBC and The Choice. But just my guess, because we don't have any staff like they have, like, and we obviously we don't even go to the same building, but I can tell you that it appears to me from that list of people who have put their names on a document that was sent out that it's clearly the majority.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what percentage, but it appears to me. Now I may be wrong about this, and we'll dig into it. a little bit more, and certainly if I'm wrong about that, I will announce a correction. And so there's two ways that a shop gets unionized in this way. One is those people say, we want a union. And they go to management and say, we want a union. And the management says, okay, we're okay with that. Or they say, well, we're going to petition the National Labor Relations Board to have an election. Now, I can tell you just from reporting on this dynamic for years, very often what management does is try and take that time. This is why people wanted card check. Because card check is, they just come in and say like, yeah, I'll sign a card. And that's it. And then
it also protects the anonymity.
Well, the majority of people, but who's the anonymity for? Like, I mean, I guess those organizing would have an idea, but a card check is just, I'm going to sign off. Yeah, I'd like to have a union. And if more than 50% of them do, then boom, then there's a union. There's no long waiting period and then a secret election later. Yeah. So that management very often uses that time to entice, cajole, intimidate.
Saw this with Amazon.
Saw this with Amazon.
In Bessemer.
So in my estimation, when your workers come to you and say, we want a union, your response should be, okay. And, you know, you tell me who I talk to. So that's what's happening. And as this story develops, we will let you know. We have obviously a responsibility to let the audience know that, you know, we have some affiliation, obviously, with Peacock. I mean, I think most people know that. With the Choice app, I mean the Peacock app, the Choice channel. I think most people know it, but I want to make sure that everybody does. So good, we did that.
Yes, you did.
Now moving on to another network. You recall this guy Tucker Carlson on what? Fox News?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so Tucker Carlson the other night came out with a bombshell. He interviewed somebody from what is it, Revolver Media?
Yes, who got their tip from a one Alex Jones, I believe, on this topic.
Is that right? Well, do we know that for sure?
That's
what Alex Jones claims.
He's involved in this conspiracy, or at least is, you know.
And the tip was, look at the indictments of some of the people from January 6th. It refers to often unindicted co-conspirators. And unindicted co-conspirators can be everybody from the president of the United States, when their lawyer is getting indicted. It can be people who were arrested and then decided to give evidence on their friends or their family or their acquaintances or their work colleagues. It could also be people who were informants before then. It's possible. And I suppose it's conceivable that it also could be actual agents of law enforcement who for some reason, you know, got caught up and were not indicted for whatever reason. But there's a long list of those things. And apparently Revolver Media saw these and assumed immediately that it was an FBI agent. And they went on Tucker Carlson's show. And the Tucker was like, the FBI was a part of the planning of the January 6th.
And I should say, I think fact checkers say that unindicted co-conspirators can't even really be actual FBI agents.
They can't actually be FBI agents because they wouldn't get indicted.
Right. It's not just like, an array of possibilities here. It's no, what Tucker proposed is not
He said they were operatives.
Operatives.
Which, like, it doesn't really mean anything, and so you get a little bit of like FBI operative is not really,
but it means everything,
and it could have been like an informant or something. And here is how Tucker Carlson slowly backs away from it. That's that, like, you know, that Homer meme where he's just sort of hides into the bushes. Here we go.
They became hysterical when we mentioned it. You can't say that, they screamed. That's not allowed. The geniuses at Twitter weighed in to inform us that the people we had described as agents of the FBI were, in fact, just FBI informants. So shut up. Hilarious. But we won't shut up, and we shouldn't. It could not be more obvious at this point that the government is, in fact, hiding something, probably quite a few things. So best to abandon the theatrics and find out what they are hiding. That's our job. To many in corporate media who claim that we are spreading Russian disinformation, instead, please calmly answer these three questions. First, how many of the so-called insurrectionists on January 6th had a relationship with the FBI? How many of these FBI moles encouraged others that day to break the law at the Capitol? We haven't heard anyone answer these questions or even address them. If the answer is none, if none of the protesters were secretly working with the FBI that day, then we were wrong. And we will apologize for it sincerely. We'll admit it immediately. But if the answer is not none, and we're pretty sure it isn't none, then people who claim otherwise are liars and hacks and should leave the public stage immediately because they have betrayed their readers and viewers. Two, if the Justice Department knew there were going to be protesters massing at the Capitol that day, and it's clear they did know, then why didn't they do anything to stop the riot? Why did police at the Capitol allow protesters to walk in, as video shows that they did? That doesn't make sense. What's going on here? Why is no one asking that question? Third and finally, why can't we see the tape for ourselves? The government is hiding more than 14,000 hours of video surveillance tape that shows exactly what did happen at the Capitol that day. Why are they hiding that? And why aren't news organizations demanding to see it? You'd hate to think that NBC News, for example, or Vox, or The Atlantic, or The Washington Post, or The Daily Beast, or The New York Times, or any of them, are in fact working to protect the regime at the expense of the public. But unfortunately, we are starting to conclude that. Please prove us wrong.
Yes, okay. Corporate media, right? I mean, Tucker's the top-rated...
Well, that is... The
Nothing's
underlying
about Fox News.
Hypocrisy of the whole thing. Number one, he went on and said that he said that the FBI operatives were the one leading this protest and this assault on the Capitol. Now, he said that, and he said it clearly with nothing but what appears to be now a hunch or a bet. And he's talking about hacks and liars in the media. Generally, even on this show, we do this show in front of IKEA backdrops. Stuff that we, you know, like a maid with scissors and tape. And we don't do stuff like that. But he is the highest rated show on that network. So the standard is actually his that he's got to meet before he goes out and spews that garbage. But now he's sort of flipping around and asking people to prove a negative to prove that he's wrong. Now, also, I remind you that the budget on any given day at Fox News is greater than probably our annual budget here.
You say that, but you're a corporate media shill. I just have to say it. So.
That may be the case.
Yeah.
I'm just saying his resources are significant. And which brings into goes to immediately to question number three, like, where's the evidence that you guys have filed a FOIA for this stuff that supposedly
journalism
nobody else is asking for? And then on number two, why did the DOJ have advanced knowledge of this? Why didn't the Capitol Police do anything? Well, it's not this regime that controlled those agencies prior to January 6th. It was the Donald Trump regime that did. And there was a mechanism. There were people asking that question. In fact, there was an entire vote to have a commission to look into those questions.
Bipartisan one.
And Republicans all voted against them. Now, I may have missed the segment, to be fair, where Tucker Carlson railed on all of those Republicans for voting against it. I'm sure he did. And just lastly, what Tucker was presenting was not Russian disinformation. It was Fox disinformation, Fox News disinformation, Tucker Carlson disinformation. He's out there arguing that other people are hacks because they can't disprove his bet. Yet, he is supposedly the most popular cable news outlet in the country Well, why don't you go investigate it? Why is it the responsibility of other media agencies to prove your negative because you're out there embarrassed about how you asserted something with absolutely no evidence? And if you've got evidence, it's your obligation to show it. Why isn't he showing it? Why don't I know it? Why do we have these questions, Emma?
Yeah, well, I mean, you say prove a negative. That's the entire basis of his program, is to assert things based on hunches, which is what conspiratorial thinking and modern day conservative conspiratorial thinking, like we mentioned, Alex Jones at the forefront. He's just a more polished version of that. That's the basis of it. And so then you just throw that out there. It percolates. It manifests. And it becomes a narrative that Louis Gohmert then parrots on the House floor. And then it becomes more real. And that's the project, not journalism. So right. Please spare us the lecture about what the media is supposed to be doing, Tucker Carlson.
Get a mirror.
Yeah.
Get a mirror.
Please. I mean, you're not going to like what you see. Maybe that's why you don't have one.
Get a mirror. If you're here, if you have a problem with the media, you should be talking to your staff. Well, maybe you can get them off their message boards.
White supremacist and, chans they're on.
And have them, actually do some work. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perrine.
Quick break.
Quick break.
Quick.
Folks, today's episode brought to you by one of our favorite sponsors, Sunset Lake CBD.
I had one of the gummies last night, and I almost tweeted about it.
Sunset
but I was
Lake.
Too relaxed to tweet about it. I was like, this is so good.
They've got gummies.
Ugh.
They've got fudge. I'm just trying to get those out of the way because this is tough. I get stuck on those sometimes when I think about them too much. Also, the tincture has been a huge boon to my sleep. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have embedded coffee. They have lotions now and a salve that I use for my eczema. But It's not meant for that, but I just happen to use for it. I find relief. I don't know if you will, but it has arnica in it, so it's good for muscles. And they are their product is it has a tremendous amount of integrity. And apparently, like in one of the issues that people have with CBD is that it they're not sure what's in it. There's third-party testers. You can go to their website. You can get they'll send you documents as to what's in this stuff. They use regenerative farming practices. They use integrated pest management. No pesticides. 100% organic fertilizer. They also have great business practices. Employee-owned. $15 minimum wage. Mostly employee-owned, I should say. $15 minimum wage. They also are movement supporters. And they've been donating and encourage you to donate to the strike that's happening in Worcester with the nurses union at St. Vincent's. It's been going on for over 100 days now, longest strike in Massachusetts in decades. And they're striking against a Texas conglomerate that is basically, you know, got this recipe of like, we just cut staffing. That's the way that we make money in the hospital business. We'll put a link to that. Just a great all around company. They're great guys, and Left is Best will get you 20% off of any of their products. Left is Best, sunsetlakecbd.com, sunsetlakecbd.com, and check it out. 20% Left is Best, one word. Also, don't know if you, like me, find that sometimes you don't have time to cook a nice meal for your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have the solution. And this is the thing, is that on my experience with HelloFresh has been not just that you get, you know, fresh pre-measured ingredients. You can find that in other places. They've got great recipes. They're seasonally adjusted. What I also like about HelloFresh is that the prep time is not like, I'm not a sous chef. It's like, give me something that's like simple, basic in terms of prep, easy, 20 minutes, and I can have a good meal for my kids. And with HelloFresh, there is something for everybody to enjoy. They have 27 recipes that you can choose from each week. They have vegetarian meals. They have calorie smart choices. They got Kraft burgers. They got extra special gourmet options. And you can do all three meals a day if you want. You could do a snack and a special treat in between. Or, but the key is that not only does it cut out the meal planning and the trips to the grocery store, you can get you can cook and you can get the dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes. This is quick. It's also 28% cheaper than shopping at your local grocery store and 72% cheaper than a restaurant meal without sacrificing the quality. That is the thing that I really enjoy about HelloFresh, is that it's quick. Because you know I got to be quick.
Yes.
That's the way I work, and I'm able to, you know, make a nice meal for the kids and sort of, you know, model like, hey, you know, look, occasionally dad cooks. And it doesn't take me, you know, an hour and a half to prep because I don't have time for that. Go to HelloFresh.com/majority12, the number 12, and use the code majority12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/majority12. It's the number 12, and code majority12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Now, sometimes you want to eat and you don't want to cook at all. And for those times, Freshly, I've told this story before.
It's a good one.
My mom is in, you know, a situation where she's like no longer cooking. And my sisters and I want to make sure that she was eating well. And this happened about, about a year and a half ago. Pre-COVID. And maybe 2 years ago now. And we wanted to buy her some meals to send. But we did some research. My sister did the research, and we came upon Freshly as the best option. And we told my mom that they were advertising on the show and that I was getting it all free. So because we were afraid that she wouldn't let us buy it. And right. She loves it. She loves it. Absolutely loves it. And every time I talk to her, she thanks me for the Freshly meals and says, I'm so happy they're advertising with you because they're so good. And she keeps talking about steak peppercorn. That was her favorite. And then I told the story and she watches the show. And so she found out.
Oh,
so,
no.
Mom, I'm sorry about the white lie, but I'm glad you like the Freshly. And now they're advertising with us completely by chance. Freshly offers chef-made, nutrient-packed, and delicious meals delivered fresh to your door. There's no cooking required. With Freshly, your meals arrive cooked and fresh every week, so you can keep your fridge stocked and skip the trip to the store and skip the whole prep thing. Ordering is easy. Freshly.com, you choose over 30 meals, like sausage-baked penne or their chicken pesto bowl or my mother's favorite, steak peppercorn. Freshly can fit your lifestyle with a variety of plans and meals to pick from that works for your needs. And now our listeners can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. Your meals are ready to heat and enjoy in 3 minutes. So check it out. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to Freshly.com/majority. Stop stressing about dinner. Go to Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's Freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. Okay, want to welcome back to the program, staff writer for The New Republic, host of The Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine. Alex, welcome. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. Sorry to keep you holding. We had to do some full disclosure up front about, the union effort at The Choice. Wanted to make sure that we weighed in on that, let everyone know our perspective on that. Turns out we're pro-union.
Oh, good, good.
Who knew?
Yeah.
All right, obviously a lot of stories this week, Joe Biden at the G7, the AUMF. I mean, I think, but we are now getting into the next 40 to 50 days, I think, are going to essentially define the legislative record of Joe Biden's term this year, this 4-year term, and it could be this 4-year term essentially ends legislatively, you know, a year from January. It could be 3 Januaries out. But either way, I think this is going to determine it, because if things don't break a certain way in the next 50 days, then I think it's just it's done. And so much of that is wrapped up in that audio that Li Fong and Ryan Grimm got at The Intercept. Just to tell everybody, it is a Zoom call between Joe Manchin and members of No Labels. Joe Lieberman's on the call.
Mm-hmm.
And he started the organization, and there's a bunch of billionaires. And it's like Manchin has given his report essentially to these billionaires. And it is fascinating. I feel like this is the basis of a civics course.
Yeah.
And let's just start with this. Well, maybe we should end with this. Like, why are we doing this? Right? Like start with,
like,
just
who was on the call that leaked this, if it's all billionaires and
Joe Manchin staff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Alex, start with that question, then we'll circle back around it after we talk about the substance, because for the life of me, I can't imagine. I mean, who would have leaked it? And it's important because it speaks to the agenda that is involved there and what people are afraid of.
I mean, it could have been leaked by whatever intern had to set up Zoom for the ancient people on the call. And I don't know. I find it to be a really fascinating document because one very annoying thing you notice when you write about politics for a long time is that you can't get senators, for example, to explain themselves on anything. You can't get them. You can't get them to give an honest account of what they're thinking, what they want. Just about everything is platitudes or misdirection. And it's very funny that we get no sense of what Joe Manchin wants to accomplish, no sense of what his goals are from him, until this moment when he's like laying it out to this group of billionaires that donate to both sides and have a really specific agenda in doing so. So they're the ones that he's like, look, here's what I actually want on electoral reform. I haven't been telling anyone this for months. I've just been stalling for time for no apparent reason. But like, here's what I would like. And I don't know why it took so long to get to that point. And I do know why he brought it to that audience first.
All right. Will you do me a favor? Also, just put your camera down just a little bit. Tilt it down just a little bit. So now, do you think, now he just released it the other day, like following the leak of this call. Do you think he released it because of the leaked call? Or do you think it was just that I can't release it until I give the heads up to the billionaires so they feel like they get the VIP seating? Right. Like this is like,
yeah,
this is the VIP thing, right? Like you come to the show, you pay the VIP tickets, you come back, you know, I'll give you a little preview of what we're going to be talking about.
Right? Yeah, totally. I think it's that. I think that's exactly what happened.
OK, so let's just go to the part of the story that got the biggest play, because this is, aside from the fact that he's doing it from his office, he never solicits money for himself.
Yeah.
This is fascinating. He is talking about Roy Blunt, and he is talking about, he is basically saying to them, look, you guys want the filibuster. I want to keep the filibuster, but I am under pressure now from people like Alex Perrin. He doesn't say your name, but I am under pressure from people like Alex Perrin to justify how I can believe in bipartisanship after the most bipartisan bill in maybe the history of bipartisan bills, that being the January 6th commission. I mean, we just played a clip of Tucker Carlson said there's all sorts of unanswered questions. You know, when Louis Gohmert's on the floor of the House saying there's unanswered questions, like, well, that's the whole point of having a commission where both sides have the ability to do it. And he knows it's making him look bad and really absurd. And he's saying to these billionaires, how you can help me preserve the filibuster is by helping Roy Blunt, who's going to retire, see the light, that it's going to be advantageous for him in his afterlife to be in favor. I need three votes. Here's that clip. Here's that clip.
It's a great, just a good friend of mine, a great guy, okay? You would like to think that Roy's retiring. If some of you all who might be working with Roy in his next life could tell him that would be nice to help our country, that would be very good to get him to change his vote, and we're going to have another vote on this thing.
Okay, that's incredible. Let's stop that right there, Lee.
Yeah, and that's the voice of Ryan Grimm saying how incredible it is. Yeah. I mean, this is it, right? Like, this is... Every bit of speculation about, you know, when we saw, what's that guy's, I can't remember now, when they did Medicare D, I can't remember his name now, but he fashioned the bill, and then literally, like, even before the bill was voted on, was already working for the the Medical Association of America. I can't remember what the story was, but, like, this is it, right? I mean, that's how it works.
Yeah. It confirms a lot of things that you previously, the only thing that you couldn't confirm about them was that you can't look directly into the mind of these people when they leave Congress and take private sector jobs. Right. But it's pretty explicit there. And it's funny because I think it gives a lot of the game away in the sense that Manchin's commitment to the filibuster represents basically a promise to these people on this call that he will stop things from getting out of hand with Democrats in charge. Like, his commitment to the filibuster is like, don't worry, Democrats aren't actually going to do the whole part of their agenda. But in order to keep that up, you really got to help, like, bribe a win for me, because it's getting, because I can no longer justify it with the language I use publicly. Like, I can no longer publicly justify it. So you got to help me out.
It's stunning. And what's also sort of bizarre about it is, then they go on, like, he, Manchin, and then Lieberman start trading sort of like, I don't know what to call it. They start trading almost like compliments with each other about being the guys who understand that they've got to do stuff for reasons that are bigger than themselves.
Yeah.
In democracy.
Well, that's how they justify it to themselves, right? That's how they justify getting on a call, carrying water for billionaires, and essentially finding purpose in their power and their thirst for power. They have to make it about democracy.
But how do you move from, dude, can't one of you guys, like, sweeten the pot at the end of the rainbow for Roy Blunt a little bit so that we can get this democracy project going?
Yeah.
Off me.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll get to that too, because he talks about that with McConnell.
Yeah,
but this is, I mean, I don't even know, like, I feel like maybe we should be just bring in, like, a psychiatrist for this. how to wrap my head around this.
I mean, carrying water for billionaires, doing what is in the interests of business, and especially, like, preventing the majority from harming those business interests is, I think, how they define democracy, right? So it's like, what they're rescuing democracy by stopping people from, you know, by rescuing democracy by coming up with completely misleading defenses for actions that are done in service of the people in this no labels call.
And if it takes a bribe.
Yeah.
Democracy moving. That's what it's just, I just find it just unbelievable. So just going over the call, they start off the call, and this is the no labels people. They start off the call by basically saying, like, look, we're going to, you know, you guys are going to be able to give us a bunch of money, and we're going to be able to give hard money to these politicians. And they love getting hard money. This is as opposed to soft money, which is like outside expenditures and PACs and whatnot, because they get to control it. And it means that at one point he says, like, they have 731 days in office as a congressperson, and they've got to be on the phone every day looking for money. And if we can deliver a check for 50 grand to them, they love us.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're talking about that. And then Manchin says, this is another thing that Manchin says about the 2017 tax cuts. Manchin says that
that McConnell was asking for his vote at first for the 2017 tax cuts. And then at the last minute, he said, we don't need your vote. Then they were able to lard it up with a lot of just only Republican stuff. And Manchin says, and that's why, you know, tax cuts like that aren't necessarily durable. His argument is that if things aren't bipartisan, they're not durable. But that's also not true.
Right.
Right. Like Social Security, did Social Security get any Republican votes? The ACA didn't.
Right.
And it just survived its third challenge.
It also survived 50 some odd votes. I mean, it's demonstrably untrue, but it's also interesting that Manchin was a vote for those tax cuts.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think like, I think what he's trying to get across to them, right, is like, you guys want things like those tax cuts, but you'd be better off if you could, you know, get Democrats like me on board with them, because then, you know, then Democrats will be less likely to lift them in the future. But I think that, I mean, we have the history on tax cuts too, and how often are they completely rolled back? You know, like it was a Democratic promise to roll back the Bush tax cuts for years, and you know that one was just gambled away.
And we should also say they didn't even have to do anything to roll back every single one of those.
No, exactly. They were supposed to expire automatically by themselves.
Automatically by themselves. And the only thing that the Democrats did was basically keep some of the tax cuts and let some of them sort of expire.
Yeah.
All right. What else stands out for you during this call?
I mean, we hit on the biggest one. I think the fact that it's the organization No Labels itself that he's sort of speaking to is really interesting. Like No Labels is just sort of treated as a sort of centrist lobby that just tries to make everyone get along. That's sort of what their branding wants you to think of them as. But they're part of a whole lobbying, campaigning, PR network, essentially. And they coordinate spending on behalf of conservative Democrats and often conservative Republicans who are maybe slightly less conservative than their colleagues. I find this peek into their access very interesting, just on its own. And Nancy Jacobson, the head of No Labels, is married to Mark Penn, who basically owns half of the political consulting business through his private equity firm. It's a whole web of influence peddling, often disguised as something else that in effect is also serves to enrich just these particular people like Jacobson and Penn and their consulting firms. And you know, a lot of it is just about drumming up business just for their own marketing, PR and campaign consulting firms.
I mean, you know, we could look at like a guy like Steve Schmidt, who was working for Howard Schultz. Mm-hmm. And also, who was the other guy that went on with him? The Obama guy. I can't remember his name now. Was it Bill? I can't remember. Bill Burton? No.
Was it Burton? I don't remember.
I don't want to besmirch anybody. but it's besmirch worthy. They were in it for millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And if Schultz had stayed in, you know, throughout the time, they're looking at multi-million-dollar payday. And a lot of these people, their feeling is like, if I'm close to wealthy people, all I need to do is encourage them that they can have influence on politics, and I'm going to get paid. And mm-hmm. whatever happens, happens. I know that I'm going to get paid. And so that drives, I think, at least some of this. I mean, it's just so hard for me to conceive that you could be looking at this, have it be divorced from policy, and think you're helping America by bribing people.
Right.
No, I should say, not even helping America, helping democracy.
They don't even think that, though, Sam. I mean, that's just the window dressing, the incredible... They do try to convince themselves of it in the moment, though, right? I mean, Alex, I'm curious if you agree with me here. But really, it's just like kind of the language with which they address the objectives that they need to attain, because it's sanitized. It's almost just like the way corporations speak about, you know, synergy and working together. It's just a very specific language for this exact kind of industry.
I think I think that's definitely true in terms of just the language that they reflectively adopt. Like, this is just the language that they use. I do think that, you know, outside of a few exceptions, most people in politics don't want to conceive of themselves as cartoonish villains. Pardon me. And so I think, you know, actually, here's another notable thing I remember from reading about the call, is that you had a Democrat on the call who was, I think, on the board of an energy company or a utility company, and who was like, Joe Manchin, thank you for not for trying to stop the government from directly subsidizing electric vehicles. Like, thank you, because the private sector can take care of themselves. And I think the ideology there is like motivated by material concerns, in the sense that that Democrat wants to get rich through the private sector, and then also like tells himself that is the best way for this to get done.
Right.
Right. And maybe one precedes the other, right? Bottom line is, yeah, Manchin went on to say about, I mean, his stuff about climate change was also interesting, because he did say, you know, a private public, you know, if the public essentially subsidizes the private entities doing this, as opposed to just coming in and paying for it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the classic, like, you guys, we will socialize the costs, but we're going to privatize the profits.
Mm-hmm.
And so you guys will be able to monetize the hell out of whatever investment we put in. That's good. And then he goes on and says, like, look, Asia's really the one who's creating climate change. We've cut back quite a bit. The best thing we can do is develop clean coal technology so that we can export it to these Asian countries, because they're not interested in developing this type of technology. I mean, I guess it's a rationale. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and it just one that helps everybody. He doesn't feel the urgency, I guess, of climate change, that like we need to do both. Like, we can develop the technology, but let's also shut down our coal fired power plants. But that gives you a sense of like why he wants to cut the electric vehicles out of the equation. Yeah. Infrastructure is because he wants it to be something that people can, you know, the private sector can profit off of. But the problem is that the problem with that, too, is that that's an incredibly inefficient way of rolling this out.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about moderate, like, this is an ancient contradiction in that sort of neoliberal approach to government policy, is that it's always more wasteful. Public-private partnerships are always, always, always more wasteful. And people and the proponents of them happen to be the exact same people who fulminate about government waste. But this is just how these things work, right? Because like, the private sector's profit has to come from somewhere.
And I mean, look, you can look at the inefficiency in the way that like we're still paying for it. The various different subways in New York City.
Yeah.
Use the subway from one line to another line because they were separate entities, and they so you've got to buy different types of cars. You got to buy different types of situations. You know, we could have a situation like, even like, if anybody who's lived in a rural area knows that there are wide swaths of places where the cable company that has been given a monopoly and also massive potential for loans, even back like in the 2008 stimulus, there was big loan program for cable companies to expand. And they just decided, you know what, we don't have enough profit to be made. So even with the subsidizing, we like 100x on our return. And
yeah.
He's only going to give us 5x, so forget it. We're just not doing it. Just give us the shareholder value that we want for my stock options to go up, and that's my compensation. I mean, it's horribly inefficient way of doing it.
Yeah, right. And I think on the call, Manchin said about the about subsidizing electric vehicles and charging stations. He was like, we're not going to, he's like, we don't want to build charging stations. So he doesn't think the federal government should. He was like, the government didn't subsidize gas stations for the Model T. It's like someone paved this country though. Like someone went to the work of putting all the roads down.
Without a doubt. And the reason why somebody didn't subsidize the building of the gas stations is because it's the gas that they make their money off of.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, that is the reason why it's going to be that much more inefficient to have the private sector do these power stations, because it's like printers.
Yeah.
The value is not in the printers, it's selling the ink.
Yeah.
Therefore, that's not the case when it comes to electricity.
It's a one-time situation.
It's
set up the charging station. And
you set up the charging station. The electricity comes in from the electric company, which has its rates capped. And you eventually will go to more sustainable energy. And by the time we have solar going into these stations, there's not going to be a huge profit margin.
Yeah.
Government can lease out, like, who gets the Piggly Wiggly there or something. Right.
So that's the exact reason you need government subsidization for this exact purpose, to spurn this.
Because, like, right, the hope with renewable energy is that it will be so ubiquitous that it will not be very profitable to be selling electricity.
Exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly. That is the success that we get to. And then he goes on, Manchin talks about his filibuster reform. You mentioned already that he laid out the voting rights thing, and we saw that released. What's been fascinating about in the wake of the filibuster reform, and I wonder if Roy Blunt came out. So Stacey Abrams supported the voting rights bill that Manchin was proposing. Roy Blunt comes out and says, because Stacey Abrams endorsed it, I'm going to reject it.
Yeah, yeah.
As if, like, that's going to make
it had a voter ID law in it too, by the way.
That, but I think Blunt does that because his name came up in this call.
100%. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And especially because, I mean, I don't know. Right. Like, his name came up in the call as someone who was bribable. But it's a funny end because, you know, the way that the Manchin actually did, again, this is why I stressed, like, why did it take so many months for this to happen? Why? Because what Manchin did is he did the classic, like, Washington move of he, like, took the good things that one side wanted to do and he threw in a few of the bad things the other side wants to do, and he jammed them together and he said, look, this will get both Blunt on our side and people like Stacey Abrams off my back. Like, finally they can come together on it. And Stacey Abrams is like, fine, compromise works for me. And of course, like, the Republicans immediately are like, no. Now that you've endorsed the compromise, it's now the Democratic bill. Like, at the second Democrats endorse the compromise, it becomes the Democratic position that must be fought.
Right. And that's what's brilliant about what Sanders is doing now with the infrastructure bill. Right. Mm-hmm. Because he's coming out and saying, like, oh, you guys have come up with a $1 trillion bill. Yeah. Well, guess what? This is the way I negotiate. $6 trillion. $6 trillion. And so when you guys come to the middle ground at like $2.1 trillion, then I will capitulate.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is it's an effective way of negotiating. This is the way I negotiate with my kids. My son says 5 more minutes of, Minecraft. And I say, OK, 3. I say, you got 5 more minutes. He says 10. And I say 3. And then he's OK with 5.
But it's different than negotiating with your kid, because the Republicans, as you say, they're not interested in the content of being negotiated. They are interested in essentially sticking it to and saying no. It's more like, you know, if your kid is just trying to act out a little bit. Like,
right.
That
if
thing.
My kid is trying to show off for his friend who's over for a play date,
right,
like,
right,
watch
right.
how I screw with dad.
Yeah.
He talks about the filibuster reform after all this. And he says that he went back and saw how they moved it from 67 to 60 early 70s. 67 to 60. And he said, he could be open to something like that. He could be open to, it seems like he wants there to be an affirmative vote for people, as opposed to now, where you could have the commission go down lose by winning only 55 votes to 35 votes, and the 35 votes wins the vote.
Yeah.
Essentially, to prevent it. He wants to go to 41. And I don't know, like, what is Mitch McConnell doing? Because Mitch McConnell came out and immediately shut down the voting rights bill and said, we're not doing it. It's like Mitch McConnell is daring him
to
do this. And Manchin mentioned on the phone, McConnell's going to be able to play just elections. He just cares about 2022, he told me. And he's going to use me as a shield because he knows I'm going to uphold the filibuster. Like, man, well, Manchin seems to be okay with getting played that way. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, it's pretty remarkable that he's sort of blunt and clear about that, because Republicans are making his life so much more difficult. Mitch McConnell in particular is, you know, the reason that Manchin is under so much pressure is because McConnell is not even allowing things like that commission to go through, you know, like, and it would be just, yeah, I guess McConnell doesn't necessarily care too much about giving Manchin a win, but the more he denies him wins, the likelier it is that there will be an effective change to the filibuster, because Manchin, like, admitted as much in this call.
Yeah, but McConnell's betting on himself, right? McConnell is betting on the horse that always wins, which is just obstruct and say no. I mean, until the Democrats give him a reason or give him an example that this isn't going to work, Alex, like,
yeah. Oh, no. I mean, I think it's absolutely an extremely plausible situation that McConnell just completely wins here. But he is, like, he's playing on a higher difficulty setting than I would think he needs to.
Well, but I think Emma's right. Like, why wouldn't McConnell just stay with this? Because it's always won for him. And if he goes down and, you know, in flames over this, OK, I mean, he's already doing better. He's already playing with house money now.
Yeah, exactly.
And so he's just going to stick with the strategy that he has followed the whole time. And we'll see where Manchin goes with this. Like, you know, we've got two separate things going on here. You know, reconciliation is going to happen unless the, you know, Gang of 10 come up with something. Bernie's pushing for $6 trillion, I think, as a way of giving Manchin some, like, breathing room to go bigger than the $1 trillion that's there. And you've got to convince Manchin to vote for this thing at you know, 50 votes, you know, for reconciliation. And then you've got the whole question about, will you get other stuff? Will there be any type of filibuster reform? All this has got to be resolved, it seems to me. At least the infrastructure thing is going to be resolved by the end of July. You know, this is, it's all coming to a head here. And so, again, let me ask you this. Who leaked this? Because it could be, it could be an intern who did the Zoom. All right. That's like somebody who's just like, I just took this job, man. And like, the greatest thing I ever done, I get this out there. Or it could be somebody who wants to pressure somebody.
Yeah.
I can't, like, the question is, who gets pressured by this? Like, what, the leaking of this, what does it most likely lead to? Does it alienate Blunt? Does it keep Blunt from voting for the January 6th commission now? Because as soon as Blunt or Toomey or Richard Burr, if they turn around and vote for the commission now, everybody's going to go, like, they did this because the billionaires are going to give them money.
Yeah.
They may not care. What would be interesting is, I mean, if I was those guys now, I'd be the ones who I would be on the floor today going, you know what Tucker Carlson is turning about. That's why, actually, I didn't know about this FBI stuff. Now we need to have a commission.
Now we need a commission right now. Yeah.
If they end up switching their vote, they're going to peg it to this.
Yeah.
And I don't think this was coordinated in any way, because you see Tucker Carlson sort of backing off it a little bit. But I wonder, you know, like, who this is meant to isolate, right? Because when stuff like this gets leaked, Alex, it's done because they want somebody to be pressured by this, right? I mean, that's why you do it. And it's unclear to me that Joe Manchin gets pressured by this.
To me, Sorry. Just my hypothesis is that it's someone on Manchin staff who thinks this is the wrong route to go down.
Which route, though? Does someone...
To continue to chase the dragon of getting bipartisanship for the January 6th commission as other priorities are in front of him.
I mean, but does this pressure Manchin in any way?
I don't know. That's a good question, because I was trying to figure out, especially once he just sort of publicly released his compromise election law thing. It feels almost... almost like it could have been leaked by someone who... wanted I think Emma, like, that actually sort of makes sense, someone who wanted them to give up on the commission and just move on to other things, by sort of painting it as, I mean, when I read that he was like, we're gonna go for this one again, I was like, come on, it's June, you're gonna go on recess in August, come on.
Like every anniversary of January 6th, you're like, let's give it another try, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, so it could have been a staffer trying to get Manchin off of the thing because it puts pressure on Blunt and makes it impossible for him to now get that.
Yeah.
It could have been somebody who actually wants to get rid of the filibuster, because I think to the extent that, like, it also could be somebody who is sympathetic to Manchin as a politician and wants everybody to know, like, he's earnest about this.
Yeah.
He doesn't see a problem with talking to billionaires. This is how he talks, you know, behind the scenes. And it sounds completely incomprehensible to me, but I mean, completely inconsistent, but it sounds, you know, sincere. Like he sounds like a lunatic to me, that he actually thinks that, like, if we can bribe somebody to vote for this thing, we'll save democracy.
Yeah.
But it's consistent with who, you know, he wants to put out there.
Right. And, you know, I think, like, his public defenses of, and again, I always try to be specific about this, his public defenses of the de facto 60 vote threshold, which is not what a filibuster is, but it's how the Senate now operates. His public defenses have been incoherent, I have thought, because he can't reveal his real reason for supporting its continued existence, which is basically to prevent progressive legislation from happening on behalf of supporters like these he was speaking to. He can't really come out and say that. So now we get a more honest account of why he has stood behind it. But we also get, I think, a sort of the first honest acknowledgement that the 60 vote threshold was not ordained by God. Because it's actually it's very funny to read him saying, like, oh, you know, I read that, you know, in the 70s, they brought it down from 67 to 60. And it's like, so have you just not been paying attention to anything anyone's been saying about this? Like, have you been plugging your ears when people have been talking about the history of the Senate filibuster for the last several years?
I imagine he has. Alex Preen, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap this thing up. All right, folks, that's it for us this week on Peacock. Emma and I will see you on
Monday.
Thanks so much for joining us. And for those of you sticking around, I just realized I didn't even say who was our guest on the show at the top of the show today, did I?
I don't remember.
Did I say anything like that, Matt? Do you remember?
It's a little bit of a blur, to be honest. I can't remember.
Oh, I guess, like, we're all out of it today. Wait a second.
I definitely am. I think I got an eye infection
during the show.
No,
the
I
show.
Told you,
Did the show give
I
you
think
an eye
I had
infection?
An allergic reaction to my new makeup remover. Like, my eye hurts.
Oh, all right. Well, I should say, Alex Perine will be on the first half of the program today. And in the second half of the program, Jason Miles and Pascal Robert of the This Is Revolution. This Is a Revolution podcast are joining us. Do we have them? All right. Then we're going to admit them into the...
Well, I should say, Alex Perine will be...
Can you hear me? Hello.
Hey, hey.
Don't let Pascal know that I mispronounced his last name.
It's Robert. It's all right, man. It's all right. People. Well,
I can't see them.
Oh. We're not used to your archaic ways of Zoom.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, yeah, how come your video presentation on your shows is so much better? Like, what do you guys use?
Restream.
What kind of mic is that, too? Wow.
This is actually a standard vocal mic. I come from the music world, so I don't have a quote-unquote podcast mic because they're for different things. Sam, you come from radio, right?
Yeah, I come from radio. So we...
It's a whole different mic setup.
We have plenty of those SM58s in the studio. So
58s are like vocal standard, and I love 58s because you can't hear my son in the background running around and throwing things because it's going one direction.
Yeah, we use those. We use those for a long time. And Pascal is a writer with, or I should say, often in the Black Agenda report.
Right.
He's often black when he writes. Yes.
And often black when he writes. And so, all right. So, guys, great to have you on. Let's just, I'm curious on your take. I know you guys have been talking a little bit about this. Today is a new federal holiday.
Oh, yeah. Juneteenth. We're super fired up. Later on, I'm going to the Freedom Fresh Fry that we're having here in Oakland.
Uh-huh.
And there's a Break in the Chains barbecue a little after that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's really what today is all about.
Is it today, though?
Yeah, isn't it?
It's today because Saturday is a normal day off.
So yeah. Gotcha.
This is the...
I'm going to celebrate it twice.
And I think, you know, yesterday we had a guest on to, you know, talk about the origins of it. And it was like more or less like a Texas holiday for a long time.
Right.
And it was sort of a barbecue. And of course, it's supposed to be taking over July 4th if everything goes well.
Oh, is that what it is?
July 4th.
Are white people afraid of that?
Actually, Tucker Carlson's hypothesis.
Yeah, that's what Tucker Carlson.
Oh, really? Tell Tucker that I said, because I know you guys have an inroad to him. Tell him I said that it's okay to barbecue twice. And this is the barbecue where he can actually have his black friend over.
Well, that first he would have to have a black friend.
Oh, he's definitely got a black friend.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
I would. He's so starkly white that I don't think he does have a black friend.
Emma, I lived for quite some time with the whitest family you can imagine. White Christian conservatives. And if they can have a Negro in their house living there rent free, Tucker Carlson can have a black friend. Kanye West is Tucker Carlson's black friend.
But guys, honestly, Pascal, no, I know you have you guys have a critique of Juneteenth, not necessarily in of itself of the holiday, but what? Give me your sense of it. I mean. Is it? I mean, I think obviously it can be a little bit overhyped as being meaningful, but it's also sort of stunning that it's taken this long to sort of recognize the importance of emancipation on some level. No?
Well, I mean, I think that for me, I wrote this piece. The last piece I wrote for Black Agenda Report was called "The Great Awakening," and the ruling class uses for racial grievance discourse is that. It's not my position is not to trivialize the importance of Juneteenth to African-Americans. I think it's a very significant holiday. It has been for people of a regional part of the country, mostly from Texas. I'm old enough to remember that growing up in New York in an African-American community, that not too many black folk in that area really talked about Juneteenth at all. I didn't learn about Juneteenth from black people until I learned from a friend who was from Texas, and I was in law school at the time. So it was very much a regional kind of celebration, people who were from Texas or maybe Arkansas or close to that proximity. And I understood how it evolved over time, particularly in digital spaces with the internet and being a kind of comprehensive, quote unquote, black holiday. But there are original or organic origins of the holiday in black social and, you know, social spaces. My problem is the way in which the ruling class establishment on the left flank of capital, the liberal establishment, is using all of this racial grievance discourse, this all kind of like black trauma porn, as I say in my piece, to really facilitate a two-pronged agenda. The first prong was in the 2020 agenda, particularly, even before so, but definitely the 2020 agenda, to use it as a bulwark against Trump, painting him as the racist ogre that he actually was, but to have particularly African-Americans, because they are such an important voting demographic to the Democratic Party, vested in seeing Trump as the anathema to everything that they have historically ever tried to achieve in this country as black people in this country. So that serves one component. And one of the persistent ways in which it was dispatched, particularly starting in 2016 when the Bernie Sanders campaign came about, was as a vehicle to basically move black Americans away from socialist, anti-capitalist, public goods forms of policy under the guise of Sanders is a class reductionist, he doesn't support reparations. And most of that discourse was being shot out from the black chattering class, black corporate media establishment, and being filtered into the ideological superstructure of black communities by people who realized that they didn't want their taxes to go up, people who are, you know, certain networks, right, for certain, mainstream corporate publications, they didn't want their taxes to go up. They didn't want to be able to lose their voice as the racial ventriloquist of the day at their particular, you know, corporate media publication. So they understood that the threat of a Sanders campaign becoming popular amongst black folk, when throughout history, throughout 20th century American history, from the Black Panther Party through people like Paul Robeson, Ella Baker, A. Philip Randolph,
Hubert Harrison,
black socialists and communists of the early 20th century, going back to the populist movement, black people in America, particularly before the McCarthy era, had always rooted large numbers of them, not all of them, a large number of them in a critique of capitalism. Even Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, before they died, rooted their challenge away from simply anti-racism to a critique of capitalism. And one of the things that really sparked Jason and I in doing this podcast together, what we had, you know, been doing work separately before that, is that we were, how offended we were that liberal media establishment was trying to paint socialism or anti-capitalist politics as a white thing. That mm-hmm. offended us to our core. And we both agreed that one of the goals of our unit coming together and creating This Is Revolution podcast, which Jason started a year before I jumped on about 6 months ago, was to completely destroy this notion that socialism or anti-capitalism or left politics is somehow just a white, you know, kind of like trust fund, you know, Jacobin reading thing. And mm-hmm. that cynical play by the liberal establishment was not accidental, because these people, we have political scientists, we have people who know African-American political history, who are well aware of this tradition. When you have someone like Jim Clyburn sitting in his office talking about, I don't know any black socialists with a picture of, with a statue of Du Bois in his office, then he lets you know that right there that his racial bona fides are more tied to big pharma than they are to black folk who are suffering from not having health care in his own community. So my problem with Juneteenth is not the problem with the holiday or its importance to black African-American people at all, but the way it's being cynically used by the liberal establishment in this great awakening to fulfill that double-pronged agenda that I talked about.
I was going to say there's a, you know, I had Glenn Ford on in the run up to the 2012 election, and he had written a piece, if I'm remembering correctly, it was like something to the effect of Obama is the more of two evils.
The more effective evil. I remember that piece. I remember that interview.
And his argument was that Obama had really effectively de-radicalized large swaths of the black community that have otherwise been some of the most radical elements of society in terms of their politics. And so if I understand what you're saying is that in stopping and attempting to stop Bernie's role, essentially in 2016, there was a further de-radicalization. In fact, not even a there was a, I guess, a
neutralization.
Think about how the conversation changed so much. So we do a video essay series for Zero Books. The latest one that's up right now, I actually sent it to Matt, is Pascal's piece. And in it, I actually take a clip from a pretty big time black radio host named Karen Hunter, where she's going off on how much she hates Bernie Sanders. And she says he's from a state with no culture. I mean, he's from New York City. Last I checked, there's culture there. And what the fuck? I'm sorry. What does that have to do with anything when it comes to his platform? And it really changed the conversation to, if you're not about reparations, then you're not really helping us. And Breonna Joy Gray actually went on Karen Hunter's show, which is, I was going to put a clip of that in, but it was just way too much. And they just really attack her on this whole, well, Bernie Sanders doesn't have a quote unquote black agenda. And we had Preston Smith the second on the show. And when he talked about the shift from social democracy to like a racial democracy, You really, when you change that language that much, you really start to neutralize any real movement, and you have, sorry, go ahead, Pascal.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a very important point. I'm glad Jason brought it up, is that racial democracy is a particular point in the long trajectory of the civil rights movement, where race first policy becomes the actual agenda of civil rights leaders, largely because of the McCarthy era, basically tramping down on the ability of the previous black civil rights established or leaders or activists who were socialists or communists, who had what we're called a social democracy type of agenda, which was a class-based, working class, working poor, challenging capital, challenging wealth hierarchy, because they realized that wealth hierarchy was the foundational crux of what the problem was, because capitalism, as we all know, renders black people disproportionately to the redundant surplus labor of arm, or reserve labor of army, and a reserve army of labor, excuse me. So the point that Preston Smith makes is that the shift to racial democracy is what facilitates having the large part of the spoils of the civil rights movement go to black people, who are pretty much closer to be middle class blacks anyway, and blacks who are working class or working poor end up getting deindustrialization, you know, mass incarceration, drug infested communities, poor housing, so on and so forth. So the civil rights, this is not to say the civil rights movement wasn't good, is that the civil rights movement was limited by the anti-socialist, anti-communist fervor at the time, as well as the Vietnam War, which didn't make funding for a kind of New Deal 2.0 at that time even possible. And as a consequence, we get this racial democracy. And the large and the important part of what Preston Smith is telling us is that what we're seeing today being projected by elites, not by working class black folk, by elites who play the role of racial ventriloquists, is that they're asking for a racial democracy agenda that will largely benefit them, including reparations. Because if you look at the reparations agendas that are being touted, usually they start with home loans, small business, black capitalism, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. This is all a black middle to upper middle class agenda that's going to benefit that class, and it's going to leave black working class and poor people behind again.
I'm sorry. Let me just tell this one thing, and then I'll let you go.
Yeah.
That I did a one time found myself on a panel with, gosh, I can't remember his name. I've brought this up a couple of times.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
No, it was...
good guess.
Von Peebles.
Yeah, Von Peebles.
Don.
What is it? Don Peebles. Don Peebles.
Von Peebles.
Don or...
Von Peebles.
It's Don.
Don. Is it, are they any kin to Nia Peebles?
Don Peebles was, unbeknownst to me, I was sitting next to him, listed as one of the top wealthiest black people in America at the time. And we started talking about the estate tax. This was, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe. And he was for the repeal of the estate tax. And he was arguing on the terms of black wealth, intergenerational wealth has not grown. Largely because of housing. And he was making an argument that we must to have wealth, some type of wealth equality. Black people need to be able to pass their wealth down to their younger generations. And I was just sort of mystified. He's telling me, like, the CBC is for it. And it wasn't until after I got off the show and realized, like, oh, he's worried about passing off his $500 million to his kids. That's what's going on here. This is not. But it was couched in this notion.
This is what the charade of racial kinship gets you when, unfortunately, people who are media personalities like yourself are forced to have to talk about the issues of black people with people who are basically black one percenters.
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We're not black one percenters.
No, far from that.
Well, don't let the microphone fool you.
It's fancy as hell, but yeah, good to know. I want to just return to Juneteenth because I think about Reagan putting MLK Day in place all the time and like it being under his administration that happened and how much that sanitized the activism of the era. And it was purposeful in that way, right? It was a way to kind of get the Reagan's racist monkey off of his back in many ways. And I'm not saying that that's what's happening here with Juneteenth, but it just, I listened to Kamala Harris at the press conference yesterday and the gravity with which she spoke about this becoming a federal holiday, as for example, Democrats have gotten nowhere on police reform or any racial justice legislation because, oh, we're keeping the filibuster in place, for example. Symbolic moves, long term, I wonder how much of a sanitizing effect it has.
How about the fact that Biden's budget calls for increasing funding to police?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to hear your guys' thoughts on that, if possible.
Jason, you want to jump in?
Oh, I'll let you go first.
Listen, man, Biden is going to milk the black trauma gravy train as far as he can to make sure that the African-American voting demographic is wedded to him in the 2022 midterms, particularly in the 2024 election. He realizes that, you know, we have the Trumpian kind of phenomenon, whether you want to call it reactionary right-wing nationalism, whether you want to call it crypto fascism. I'm not interested in the debate about whether or not Trump and his acolytes are fascist or not. What I do know is that they are reactionary nationalists and there is a massive racialized component to their policy. And I'm not by any far a Trump supporter, nor am I carrying the water of the Democratic Party. My politics are to the left of both of them. But at the same time, we got to realize that the Democratic Party is in a crisis. And as much as I'm hearing this discourse about Biden being the new FDR, which I think is ridiculous, is that this is all rooted in realization that the Democratic Party, particularly for Americans under 40, cross-racially, has been a more brutal bearer of the 50-year counter-revolution of neoliberalism. NAFTA, GATT, mass incarceration, financial deregulation, all of that between Biden, Clinton, Obama, and young people who use social internet and digital media to get their news and don't depend on corporate media are realizing this, so much so that you're even seeing a very small marginal increase in black spaces of support for Trump, which we witnessed in the 2020 election. And the Democratic Party has a credibility problem. And what they realize is that if they don't find some way to policy-wise tamp down this disaffection for their party, for particularly for the under 40 demographic, they may lose it to the reactionary right for another two political terms.
The right F's up because they're just so goddamn, sorry, so racist.
But does,
they weren't so damn racist. They would definitely probably have more of a black vote because there's so many black people that are starting to get disaffected. Like Pascal said, with the Democratic Party, I know several people that are like fans of Candace Owens because she critiques the Democratic Party.
But does, but let me ask you this. Does, do you think the Democratic Party, to the extent that there is a Democratic Party, the establishment that exists now, particularly like sort of like it's an older establishment. Mm-hmm. If they are aware of the potential for hemorrhaging black support and are heightening the racial porn, however you want to.
Racial porn, it has a lot of connotations.
It really, racial violence porn, it really is.
Trauma,
really
the racial grievance discourse. How about I say the racial grievance discourse?
If they are heightening that as a way of do you think that that is because there is a lack of understanding where that hemorrhaging is happening, or do you think that's the only sort of response that they can give and maintain their own agenda and they're just hoping it works out?
It works so well. If I sit here and tell you about slavery and talking to white people about slavery, we're not challenging capital.
But I mean, does it work so well, though, to maintain black support?
My position is this. I think it works well for a certain class of black voter. I think the professional managerial class, the petite bourgeois African-American community feels great that their boss is going to be able to tell them happy Juneteenth and that Kamala Harris chucks and pearls, all of that kind of vapid symbolism. They still have Obama, so on and so forth. I think black working class and poorer communities are becoming more and more outraged by the level of betrayal that they've seen by the Democratic Party. And as a result, their discourse is becoming somewhat more reactionary and in tune with supporting Trump, particularly younger black men and even some younger black women. You can see by the social media personalities that are becoming popular in African-American spaces, which are being marketed as being liberatory, but really kind of this circulating reactionary kind of old school talk of family values talking points, that their frustration, and they're justified in having frustration with the Democratic Party, but in using conservative language and the conservative, the right wing conservative party as the apt alternative in the age of Trump is not the answer here. And I'm not particularly saying that Sanders and his agenda is the answer, but to your larger point, what is dangerous right now, to something you alluded to, Sam, is that for the first time, and I would argue modern American political history, perhaps any time in American history, the fulcrum of black electoral politics is existing to the right of white progressives. I don't think that's ever happened before. Even when you think of Jesse Jackson was in the left flank of the Democratic Party. If you think from the 60s, you think, prior to the McCarthy era, you think to the populist era, the abolitionists, there was always a large portion of black voters. Not that there hasn't been black conservatives in the past, but there was always a large fulcrum of black voters who were not only in line with white progressives, but had to pull them along and get them out of their own racial chauvinism and were the vanguard. But now the fulcrum of black electoral politics, not all of it, electoral politics is wedded largely because of starting with Clinton, but now with Obama, in the right flank of the Democratic Party. And for me, as someone who's a student of black political history, that's something that rings serious alarms.
Now, so you're talking about people like Clyburn and the constituency that he brought into the race, right? I mean, the black cohort that voted for Biden, but does that necessarily mean that the that the answer is for those folks, a more egalitarian set of policies that are not necessarily, policies that are more geared towards the working class.
Well, my question is this. Since African-Americans have twice the rate of poverty of whites and a larger percentage of the majority of blacks are working class or working poor, how is it that working class or working poor policies are not going to benefit mostly African-Americans? How are African-Americans not benefiting from a federal jobs guarantee?
No, I agree with that. But I'm saying from an electoral standpoint, when you tell me that the fulcrum is now to the right of white progressives, what would make policies that are associated with the left? And I'm talking about, like, not from a cultural standpoint, but from an economic standpoint. Why would that necessarily appeal to those that black cohort that is to the right of those white progressives?
This is the thing, though. This is something about black politics that I think is important for particularly progressives, white or otherwise, who try to understand and ask questions like, why did black people vote for Joe Biden? I don't understand. The policies that Bernie has are so much better. Black politics is a politics of containment and capture. What does that mean? How does black politics work? When the South Carolina primaries are about to happen, Jim Clyburn has the phone number of every black church pastor in his Rolodex. Every black membership organization, fraternity, sorority, graduate chapter, and alumni chapter, which in those chapters are the teachers, the principals, and all of the administrative officials of your black high schools, okay? All of the historically black colleges and universities, which are going to be in South Carolina, a large number of students, which is going to literally have an ideological role in shaping the politics of thousands of students. What I'm trying to say is that the way in which Clyburn does this is not because black people will, if you explain the policies to them, will not understand, this stuff, federal jobs guarantee and universal health care is better for us. It's that the ideological infrastructure is controlled by the black political class, and they maintain that control by exacting patronage, which I call fatback and biscuits, from the Democratic Party and its corporate acolytes, and handing it out piecemeal to people who are within their constituency through public service types of policies. And that aspect of how black politics works is what, in order for anyone who's interested in having any kind of left, and I've said this and I'll say it again, you will not have a left in America with effective politics without black people. Because there's never been a left in America with effective politics without black people. And if you do not do that, black politics will be used to destroy the left, like it was done in 2016 and 2020. You have to understand and find a way to puncture the ideological superstructure that allows people like Clyburn to basically take large segments of black voters and dump them into the neoliberal corporate section of the Democratic Party.
But is that an ideological superstructure, or is that just simply a structure? I mean, it sounds to me
it's ideological in that you have people voting against their interests.
Well, in practice, but I'm saying it is built upon simply patronage, right? Like, I mean, that is why, like, the Clintons did.
It's deeper than patronage. Patronage, relationships, certain type of aspects of social and cultural traditions of how black leadership is viewed. I mean, there's a lot of ideological superstructure type baggage involved here, and what allows these things to happen.
You could probably say the same thing about Chuck Rocha when he talks about delivering the Latino vote, right?
I mean, I would imagine that there is. I mean, I would imagine it depends on the region, obviously. I think, as to how dense and how centralized ultimately, these networks are on some level.
Well, I can tell you this. The politician in my lifetime, and I'm a little bit older than probably everyone here except maybe Sam, is that the politician in my lifetime who mastered the ideological superstructure of the black communities first was Bill Clinton.
Right, right. That's what I'm saying.
Bill Clinton, what was the name of Toni Morrison? She's our first black president. Bill Clinton knew how to mimic African-American cultural affectation in a way. It's like, oh, I love those collard greens, child. Oh, you know, give me that fat back. I love it too. Forget about what that Pascal Robert is saying. You know, his ability to sound like that good old white boy you knew who, yeah, maybe his uncle was a Klans member, but, you know, he'd hook you up and give you some, you know, some tires if you needed to if your truck wasn't working. So,
again, get you out of town.
You know, he mastered that. And yet, at the same time, some of the worst damages of the neoliberal agenda were handed down by Clinton on African-American communities, from mass incarceration,
welfare to work.
The financial deregulation that led to the subprime mortgage crisis that stripped away over 35 to 50% of black wealth, et cetera. So,
well, I guess that's my point: is that Clinton wasn't necessarily presenting an ideological superstructure in terms of being able to tap into that network. He was doing it on sheer either, you know, on some level of charisma and of personal relations that. Right. Were completely depoliticized contrary. It was absence of ideology.
I'm not saying that he or the politicians are the ideological infrastructure. The ideological infrastructure exists within the black communal space because of the black political class in and of itself. The structures are things that have existed even before the civil rights movement. They go back to the 19th century. And what I'm saying is that because black politics is a politics of containment in which you have an elite tier of black people who are ventriloquists for a group of blacks who are silent and mute and unable to speak for themselves because of the charade of racial kinship, all you have to do is get that race management in elite to be in line with whoever the representative of the ruling class is of the day. And he's able to take the ideological superstructure of the community and shift them in line and say, it's like, oh, you know, this is a good old boy. Hey, we know we can trust him, et cetera, et cetera. Because so much of the communal voice has been based on trusting that quote unquote racial ventriloquist for so long.
To tell you who's the right white dude to trust, right?
Yeah.
Like, again, if you go back and if you guys have, you know, 15 minutes to spare and watch the video essay that we did, when you see that clip on the Karen Hunter show, I actually cut in a call that she takes. And the gentleman calling is like, you know, we don't need to be voting for Bernie Sanders because he's had 20 plus years in office to do something for black people and he hasn't done anything. And, you know, Karen kind of gives him the right on. Like he's never done anything for anybody in his entire time in office.
Compared to Hillary Clinton, compared to Joe Biden. It's absurd.
It is absurd. It's frighteningly absurd. But when you hear it from that level, like right from the horse's mouth, I'm not doing super cuts or edits. It's like, here's the intro of her show, her telling you why she doesn't like Bernie Sanders. And none of it is about policy. And when you listen to the way she talks, it's literally what Pascal is saying.
My point is this. I'm not trying to make Bernie Sanders to be the savior of black people by any stretch of the imagination. My position is very simple, is that on materialist levels, I don't understand how a federal jobs guarantee, how universal health care, how free higher education at a state university level are not issues that are bettering the lives of poor and working class black people. I don't see how an agenda that is concentrated on changing the lives of poor and working class people who make up the majority of the black community economically is not an agenda that benefits black people. But because you're going to have people like media personalities that Jason mentioned who would tell you, I just don't like that Bernie Sanders.
Black people don't understand what the word oligarch means. Remember when Jason Johnson said that?
Yeah, they don't. Oh, how about vampire? They understand vampire. How about landlord? How about corporate pimp? They understand that. You know, listen, this is how bad it gets. I was on a radio program with a friend of mine who comes on our show regularly. She has a black radio program. And we were debating this about right after Biden won the election. And someone, this is a African-American political scientist, told me, he was like, oh, you leftist. He's like, black people don't know nothing about political economy. I was like, black people don't know anything about political. Do black people pay bills? What are you talking about?
I mean, but let me ask you this. What makes your argument different from ultimately? From if I was to say to you, well, look, I can also point to members of the white working class, mm-hmm. Who also are not activated by policies, you know, that they are in some respects also equally as distracted by cultural things
or racism.
In this instance, it's usually racism. In some sense, that like, how come I have to press number two to speak English, or when I call in, or how come whatever it is, how come there's a black guy centered in the Cialis commercial and not someone who looks like me, like my dad? Is it really a unique dynamic? Within the context, obviously, in terms of for black people, that the left uses more of this sort of symbolic stuff that doesn't necessarily address the actual material needs of a significant portion of black people. But there's also, white people who vote against their economic interests. And
my argument, I'm not going to accuse you of making a straw man argument, Sam, is that my argument has never been that only black people are lied to by politicians or played by politicians. I would argue that most right wing Trump voters got played as well.
Played, or is it just that they have a different set of they have a different
they got played. I'll say it. They got played.
Sam,
I spent the last 10 or so years playing rock music, traveling all over the middle of the country. And I'm a black dude that it was in a lot of spaces I kind of had no business being in. And for whatever reason, I got to hear all the white grievance.
Well, they got played, as you say, but they may be more satiated by like the racism and
hell yeah, they were
the
yeah.
same way people hell are yeah, satiated by Chucks and Pearls and Kamala Harris.
Yeah, it's the same thing. They definitely got played, and being able to reach out to cats like that, you really have to start breaking stuff down, like how Pascal is talking about, like kind of plain and simple social democratic policies that kind of help everybody.
I mean,
my point is, Sam, to answer your question, is that the ruling class has two flanks from my vantage point. You may disagree. The left flank and the right flank. They both want to protect capital. Right? Let's make this clear. They're both in the same business. This charade in right left is a game that they are playing to protect capital. Okay. Some of them might be like, oh, you know, I like to have black people around me. Some of them, you know, might not. There's a great African-American historian who wrote a book called Contempt and Pity, which talks about the ruling class's positions and views of African-Americans throughout history. And his argument is that the position is one of contempt or pity, that the right uses contempt for black people and the liberals use pity for black people in terms of how they view them. Neither one has any respect for them, but they basically live within that kind of situation. I think that with the right, when it comes to poor and working class whites, they don't have contempt, but they have a kind of like we'll use them, kind of like, you know, they look at them as kind of like, you know, he's an ignorant sucker. So I can use, like Nixon used the hard hats in the early 70s, you know, as a perfect example. It's like, you know, this guy's waving his red, white, and blue. He loves his country. He's a great American. Wonder. Yeah, we can tell him, like, yeah, these black folks are going to come into your neighborhood and decrease your real estate values. You got to vote Republican to protect your interests. And they capture that vote. So, yes, they know how to appeal to that racism. That doesn't mean they're not getting played. It just means that their racism is what's playing them.
No, I agree that they're getting played, but they also are quite content on some level. Like they're getting what they're not being offered an agenda that is different than they're getting. They may not be getting what they need or what we think they need, but they're being satiated on some of by this. And I guess my argument is it seems to me. But
the black political class and its acolytes are being satiated as well. This is a class black pop. We had Adolf Reed on our show, and he said point blank that black politics is a class politics, and it's a class politics that doesn't represent the class interests of the majority of black people.
Yes. I mean, I would agree with that. That's why I'm bringing up that I'm making that that analogy. And I guess what I'm saying is that, like, I got a choice. Do I explain to people that Bernie, and maybe it's not a mutually exclusive choice. Do I explain to people that I'm saying that this is what occurs to me at this moment. Is there a choice between the idea of explaining to people the value of the policy set that Bernie Sanders would provide, or I can take Bernie Sanders' policies and embed them in Bill Clinton's folksy charm and deploy Bernie Sanders out there, you know, and he has developed those relationships. I mean, I'm quite convinced that had Bernie Sanders started his campaign in 2016, 6 to 8 months earlier, and actually made attempts to go down and do what he had to do to develop any type of relationships for that Southern swing. He's not going to win the entire network, but he's going to be able to maybe take a strain of it.
Pick up some delegates.
Pick up some delegates by making relationships with a couple of pastors, making relationships with a couple of, party bosses, as it were, community leaders. That 2016 could have worked out very, very differently. I'm not so much sure about 2020, but 2016 anyways. But he didn't do that. I mean, because he didn't run. He was running a message campaign until very late in the campaign.
Oh,
I think
got real. Yeah.
And so, I mean, but give me your sense of that. Like, I mean, are we talking about politics is in fact, you know, about, like, you know, relatively thin in terms of what the average voter, regardless of race, wants from their politician, as opposed to what they end up delivering from a material benefit that may keep them in office?
I mean, I think the larger reality is that let's focus on the Democratic Party, is that this is the option we have. Do we believe in a public goods form of governance, or do we believe in a form of governance rooted in serving the needs of capital and corporations? I believe that the traditional corporate wing of the Democratic Party, the neoliberal wing that kind of starts with Jimmy Carter, metastasizes with Bill Clinton, continues through Obama, and still exists with Joe Biden, even though he's trying. Biden even himself realizes that he's got to switch the paradigm somehow.
Yep.
All right. So the question becomes, do we want a public goods form of governance? I think what is even more tragic about the moment is that with the rise of the charade that the Trump presidency presented, that even his own acolytes and supporters are in favor of some form of public goods governance, as long as they have that racist kind of white nationalist tinge to it. You see what I'm saying? In that Trump comes out and saying, you know what? I think having you be able to buy Canadian medicine and giving you guys some kind of federal job guarantee with an infrastructure plan, or maybe some student loan forgiveness. There were several times that Trump whistled at more left policy and politics than the Democrats were offering. And he knew it was great meat to throw to his base. Not that he would implement it, because he's wedded to the same capitalist parasites that Democrats are. But my point is that as many people more brilliant than I could ever been have said, we are in an age where we have right-wing populism and left-wing populism. And what I'm saying is that right-wing populism always has a racial overtone to it. Left-wing populism traditionally has not been able to take off without Black people. Why are Black people not involved in racial in left-wing populism? Because Black politics is stuck in the right wing of the left flank of capital. And that's because the ideological superstructure, because of the Black political class and its class acolytes, is wedded to keeping Black people through symbolic leadership of achievement through people like Kamala Harris and Obama in that fulcrum and that flank of the Democratic Party.
And it's going to be a disaster. Black mayors.
Yeah, Black mayors, until we shatter that. My argument in this is a suggestion I made, is that the only way we're going to shatter this and have any kind of left populist project is that if the existing infrastructure of the Bernie Sanders coterie. I don't think Bernie Sanders is the savior of anyone, but the agenda and an agenda that challenges capital and demands a public goods governance is what we need at this stage of the crisis of capitalism. If we believe that, the question becomes this: how do we get Black people out of the right wing of the Democratic Party and joining this populist coalition? And I think the way you penetrate that is that what is the organization that exists that has the national scope and membership capacity to take these Black PMC professional managerial class individuals and their acolytes and give them the political education to shift their politics away from the neoliberal faction and into that kind of new public goods governance? And I think Democratic Socialists of America is a starting point. I don't think that they're the answer to all questions, but I think that they are a starting point for a way in which you can get these people to join into these kind of organizations in their local capacities and possibly think about learning something about anti-capitalist Democratic Socialist politics. People laugh when I said it, but what I'm saying is that, what would you rather have? The whole leadership cadre of Black politics in America stuck supporting neoliberals, talking about how they want Robert Smith to develop plans for the Black community, a billionaire?
I mean, I'm in complete agreement with that, and the necessity of moving at least big elements of the Black community to that worldview where they understand, you know, where they want that type of governance, where that becomes paramount. I guess and I think DSA is a big part of that. But I also think that what also could be involved in this is simply infiltrating Democratic politics. I mean, if you have the problem is that, like, you're at a keyboard, aren't you?
No, I have a board.
Okay, there you go.
blame Doug Lane.
I thought that was one of the tribes.
The CBC is is problematic in this regard.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, and there needs to be more members. You know, you need to have more Jamal Bowmans,
Cory Bushes.
But here's my thing to that. I actually did a lot of work on Shahid Buttar's campaign. I would go so far as to say Shahid actually is a really good friend, and I was there with him when that campaign disintegrated.
Right.
I was there with him the day he finally got on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. It took like a year plus for the Chronicle to run any pieces on him whatsoever. And they couldn't wait the next week to have him above the fold about a scandal. Right. And you're not just running against a Republican, you're running against the entire Democratic establishment. And of course he was running against Nancy Pelosi, who kind of sort of is the Democratic establishment. She gave so many non-Fs that she didn't even bother to debate him.
Right.
That's the biggest middle finger. Like, I'm going to let you fall apart on your own. And we could say certain things about DSA and that as well, but we won't get into it. We had a young lady on the show yesterday who's running for one of the California State Assembly seats that's up right now because of all the shifting around with Kamala Harris in the vice presidency. And it's a seat actually for the area that I live in. And the incumbent for that seat is the wife of the guy that just left it. And she's tied to real estate lobbies. Now we look at the 2028 Olympics is coming to LA, much like the 1984 Olympics that came to LA. And what did we get from that? You get a lot of the tough on crime laws. You get a lot of the militarized police forces that you see today starting from that. And now when you look at some of the programs that LA has to do homeless sweeps, because California has a horrible homeless problem that I actually worked in and was for some time. It's just get you in, get you the F out, because we have real estate lobbies behind this, making it sound like these are programs that are going to help people. And she was on the show and she brought up a point that she would be only one of two other people that actually rent Everyone else is a homeowner and tied to real estate lobbies. Yeah. Home buying in California, you guys are in New York, so you understand the prices are insane. Business Insider just did a piece yesterday that said, look, if you're trying to buy a house with a loan, sorry for you. You better be able to liquidize some stock options like the rest of these tech people can and put cash in. It is so bad buying a house right now. There's clauses for overbidding that say if I overbid, and the appraisal comes in low, I will give you the cash difference and I'm overbidding. In California, we had a house that sold a few years ago for $825,000 over asking for a 3 and a 2, a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house. We're not talking about a mansion. We're talking about a regular standard home that you would probably see somewhere in Long Island, a 3 and a 2, $800,000 over. You're going up against standing capital, and the Democratic Party is so wedded to this. So to try to come in, the obstacles that this young lady faces for a state assembly seat, the right. woman she's up against already raised $1 million. Nancy Pelosi on a lunch had raised $80 million for all these Democratic Party people when Shahid is over here. I'm knocking on doors trying to get $5.
I mean, I think that, like, you know, I mean, and I was definitely supportive of Shahid's candidacy. But I think that in terms of like a broad strategy, you know, running against the Speaker of the House is going to be tough. Although it works with maybe the whip, right, in New York.
Yeah.
So, but I guess my point is that it, and these are not mutually exclusive, you know, ideas, but you need to take control of some of the substructure because, you know, ultimately, you know, like I say, if Bernie Sanders had taken 10-15% of that structure and that Southern trip down in the primaries in 2016, you know, I think he would have won that. I think he would have won that primary. And I mean, there could have been, you know, who knows how, you know, the Clintons would have reacted. But I think like the idea being that you take the low hanging parts of the substructure, which is, you know, where you see Justice Democrats, for instance, you know, going for seats in blue districts that are not sufficiently to the left, and going after them so that you have less hurdles, so that you win by winning a primary, you win a general, and taking over parts of that substructure. I don't think these are mutually exclusive ideas, but it seems to me that ultimately, like, it's a hard road to hoe to convince that many people that, because, like, look, I mean, from my perspective, the it is, and you guys obviously far more in touch with this, but it's very hard to argue that it has to be an either or situation in terms of presenting both material benefits that are that take class into account. And you also have to ignore sort of the racial impacts of it, of the racial dynamics that are going on in society. And
I don't think either one of us are making the argument that materialist based politics means that you ignore racism. First of all, if you understand how capitalism works in the West or in America, you realize that capitalism demands, as we stated before, that Black people are disproportionately rendered to the reserve army of labor. So there's a racial notion, nature to how capitalism functions, and all the social harm and dislocation that comes from capitalism is leveled on, you know, poor and working class Blacks to make Blackness a metaphor for poverty. In America, because, and we know this happens because if the white majority realized that more of them were poor, not by per capita, by sheer number, they probably would rebel. And this is part of the nature of what keeps capitalism functioning in America. So anyone who shares the kind of socialist vision that me and Jason has, who doesn't think challenging racism is important, is basically just, you know, a racially chauvinist sock them. And we got lots of them. And we call them out on our show all the time.
Right. I'm not even talking from a theoretical standpoint. I mean, I'm talking, you know, as an electoral matter, as of just sheer, you know, sort of like retail and wholesale, really more wholesale politicking, and that, you know, I would imagine that, like, you know, it's just as important for a Bernie Sanders style politician who is providing a program of material benefit for the working class to also, you know, celebrate Juneteenth.
I understand you. In other words, what you're saying is that if you know you have the material politics that would be beneficial to black constituency disproportionately, then you should develop the cultural competency to penetrate the spaces that charlatans like Bill Clinton have been able to do and be able to actually do it with genuine care and compassion, yes, as opposed to seeming racially tone deaf.
Exactly.
Yep.
That's what the young lady was doing that was on our show. Janani Rashandaran is actually her name. And, you know, she's literally going into black churches, but she comes from, again, much like Shahid.
This is important. Movement. Let me tell you something. And we've had some great guests from DSA. And when people, we asked this on several occasions in terms of suggestions for how to increase left politics in black communities, we say one thing, and on two occasions, their eyes glazed. We said, well, why don't you go into the black churches? Not that's a good idea, or we messed up for not doing it. It was kind of like, like, what do y'all think they're going to crucify you? I mean, like, why the trepidation that was demonstrated by these guys? I was like, how do you think that the politics that gets Clinton and Obama in office transpires? What do you think the souls to the polls? What do you think that's about?
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like fruit to me. Like, there's a reason why they want not to keep the polls open on Sundays.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
I'm over here stuttering like Sam. The shows that happened on, and we're not going to say which shows those were, was hilarious to see the what? Who? Because there's a fear almost of going into these spaces. And I don't understand the fear. I really don't.
Well, the question becomes, then, what exactly is the class makeup on the intention of the DSA project? And listen, Jason gives me hell for this. I recently joined the Miami DSA. I recently did. And because I actually want to implement this kind of agenda of actually infiltrating the DSA with black folk who have some kind of political experience or worldview, and stopping this ridiculous notion of, like, we should go, what you mean we should go into black churches? I'm like, of course you should go into black churches. I'm like, how do you not realize why you should go into black churches? You know, and again, DSA has been effective in achieving things. They have great infrastructure, but they, you know, the whole, like, you know, image of being trust fund kind of, like, you know, chilling out in the loft in New York City, sipping lattes, like, you know,
people.
That's kind of problematic.
Hipsters out of town.
I mean, that to me sounds like a just tremendous amount of political inexperience. I mean, it's like kissing babies. What? Like, yeah. Well, look, we got to go. But guys, this has been
This is Revolution Podcast on YouTube. This is Revolution Podcast on all the relevant social media apps, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Podcaster. We live stream on Tuesdays, 9 p.m. Thursdays, 9 p.m. We have the Foreign Policy Thursdays. And on Saturday, noon, Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And Saturday. You say Saturday?
Saturday, noon, Eastern Standard Time, yes.
Okay. Great. Well, folks, guys, it was real pleasure to have
Follow
you.
Follow us on Twitter. This is Revolution Oakland.
Pascal, why are you trying to get us banned?
We're going to put all this in our podcast and YouTube description. And so everybody will have your links there. Guys, really appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Take care.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the, I guess.
The fun 20 minutes.
I guess we're going to just go Freebie Friday.
Whoa.
Hey, Freebie Fridays are significant. I remember before I worked on this show, my first Freebie Friday, like, whoa, this show is way longer today. And I enjoyed my first fun half.
There you go. That's why we do it. That's how we got Matt. That's how we pulled Matt in. Let's see. What should we get to on?
I mean, I think maybe we should cover the AUMF stuff. Barbara Lee and or Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, but which clip is that? The number
11 and 12.
Okay, yeah, good.
Good pair.
It's possible to overstate the relevance of the rollback of the AUMF, the 2002 one in particular, because A, that is more oriented towards Iraq. B, presidents have been able to engage in what they now call kinetic activity, as opposed to war making, without having to cite the AUMF, although it's sort of been like a secondary justification. However, it's also possible that in ending the 2002 AUMF, we may end up seeing the end of the 2001 AUMF. And this may be an indication that Congress is trying to reassert itself. Don't hold your breath, but reassert itself in the war making ability of this country.
But we're also not getting rid of either AUMF without the filibuster.
Without the filibuster going away.
McConnell already said that he's blocking this. Right. I mean, okay, you got Mike Lee, maybe, and then you got Rand Paul. And
right, right.
You need eight more.
Here is Ilhan Omar talking about her experience of living through war.
Thank you, Chairman. And thank you to our distinguished author, Congresswoman Lee, for bringing forth this legislation. Madam Speaker, for the past 20 years, the 2002 authorization has been used to wage war and cause destruction around the world. While many in this Congress have participated in war, I'm someone who has endured war and understand the impact it has on innocent lives. The act of war does nothing to make us safe. Engaging in endless wars has led us to undermining our most important morals, peace, liberty, and justice.
Impressive, you know, I mean, to have at least someone give some type of insight into what it feels like to be subjected to the war that at the very least the 2002 AUMF unleashed in this instance in Iraq. Here is Barbara Lee introducing the bill to repeal the 2002 AUMF. She was the only person to vote against the 2001 AUMF. I don't know if she was the only person to vote against the 2002. I don't think she was.
I don't believe so, but still, just the courage cannot be overstated.
Right. She has the sort of the moral legitimacy, and frankly, one could argue just sort of even the practical legitimacy of like noting like this didn't work out so well.
Right.
Now, 18 years ago, in front of the infamous Mission Accomplished banner backdrop, former President Bush told the nation that the major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In 2011, President Obama brought our combat troops home, and yet this authority remains on the books, vulnerable to misuse because Congress has not acted to remove it. The Bush administration, yes, misled the American people by saying there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that Iraq posed an imminent threat, and by drawing a false connection between the tragic events of 9/11 and Saddam Hussein. Those lies and misinformation had deadly consequences. The mistakes continue to haunt us today. Once the war started, started, led by Chairwoman Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, and myself. We founded the Out of Iraq Caucus. Over 80 members joined. Many of us took our protest to the streets, joining hundreds of thousands protesting the unnecessary, immoral war of choice. Year after year, we worked for the safe and orderly withdrawal of our troops. I share all this history because, not because of nostalgia, but we have to remember why this authorization was passed. Because 87% of members of Congress now of the current House were not here to vote on this AUMF in 2002. The Constitution requires that we cannot appropriate funds for armies for more than 2 years. And yet, for almost two decades, we have failed to revisit these AUMFs. To this day, our endless war continues, costing trillions of dollars and thousands of lives in a war that goes way beyond any scope that Congress conceived or intended. And I want to salute our veterans, our young men and women in uniform. They did everything we've asked them to do. Many veterans support this repeal. The outdated 2002 AUMF, it bears no correlation to the threats we face today. The president earlier made clear when he stated his support for the bill. Can I have another just 10 seconds?
I yield, gentle lady, another 10 seconds. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. The president stated his support for the bill, saying that the 2002 AUMF will not impact current military operations, but repeal can prevent our country from entering another protracted engagement under this outdated authority.
I mean, there it is. So, I mean, it's good that the House voted against it. I don't think we'll see the action in the Senate necessarily. But it was a process for the House and to relinquish its authority to wage war. And, it's going to take more than a couple of votes, obviously, and I don't know that they'll ever, really have that balance. But the presidency and its ability to sort of wage war, it's frankly out of control. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And no president, regardless of party, is going to sort of cede that power unless...
We saw it with Obama, who ran on an anti-war platform, and that's how he essentially got into office. And then he did not curtail the complete disintegration of protections or roll them back that allowed for these kinds of abuses to happen. And just to return to Ilhan Omar for a second, she's experienced war. She was in a refugee camp, for example, just one of the many horrors and difficulties she had to face due to war. So much of the United States' arrogance is because no one in this population has had war on our shores. Of course, Americans have experienced mass shootings, whatever the case may be. But, we have not seen war waged in Indiana or in Florida or in Vermont, wherever. And that's really, I think, integral to the cavalier attitude that we have about murdering people in either a sanitized way via drones or in warfare and in waging war. It's changed a bit, but to have that voice in Congress, someone who has personally experienced it in her country, in her home country, you can't overstate that.
Yep.
So.
All right, let's do this one clip, too. This is pretty stunning. So it's 15 seconds long. Let's just start with a clip of Roy Blunt. This is Roy Blunt basically breaking Joe Manchin's heart because he is making it impossible for Joe Manchin to maintain this fiction of bipartisanship.
I think every one of us looks for opportunities to work with Senator Manchin, and we found those opportunities. I actually think when Stacey Abrams immediately endorsed Senator Manchin's proposal, it became the Stacey Abrams substitute, not the Joe Manchin substitute.
Oh, because she endorsed it. So, this is what we're dealing with, too. So, Manchin, get it together. If you propose it, and if anybody, they're not going to back it at all. But the fact that Stacey Abrams endorsed it gives them an immediate out, saying, hey, we're not going to back this.
I mean, it's maybe a lesson for progressive for liberal left, you know, advocacy groups, that if you have some, if you want to show support for some, maybe do it private first.
Yeah.
I mean, but it is, but it's also, I mean, how many lessons does Joe Manchin need? And to be told that they are not going to vote for this stuff, that if there is any, that they are allergic not to the bills, they are allergic to compromise. Fundamentally, I'm not saying that that I lament this. I don't. I think this is a perfect opportunity to teach Joe Manchin that it is unsustainable for him to pretend that there is an opportunity for bipartisanship. And I mean, to the point where you basically had to beg Joe Manchin billionaires to buy off that guy, Roy Blunt, so that he votes for that January 6th bipartisan developed, bipartisan executed, bipartisan in practice commission. And it's still a question as to whether he's going to even do it for just pure cash. Because you need to justify your adherence to the filibuster.
Oh, I mean, well, Roy Blunt will have a way to cash in no matter what. I mean, once he leaves office, this is not the only opportunity that's going to be thrown at him, given how much he served corporate interests during his time there.
Without a doubt. But it's I mean, and I think, you know, Manchin was saying that, like, some of you guys are going to hire him, right? Anyways, maybe
sweeten it
a little bit. Like,
go on that.
Can I just say the him saying we would have supported it until the black lady said she would support it. I like to point out when there's cases of nominative determinism. And if you don't know what that is, nominative determinism is the hypothesis that people tend to gravitate towards areas of work that fit their names. Anyway, Blunt is his last name. Like,
there you go.
Yeah. Again, if Democrats keep negotiating with Republicans on the understanding, a misplaced understanding, that it's the content of the bill that they're actually negotiating with them on, you're going to lose every single time. It has nothing to do with what's in the legislation. They're a party of simply owning the libs at this point. It's all about, you know, who is behind it, and it's about obstructing everything the Democrats
want. And again, this is the value of Bernie Sanders coming out and saying $6 trillion.
Move the goalpost Japan.
This is the value of him doing that, because he knows it's not going to be a $6 trillion bill. But what he has done is given Joe Manchin a very wide berth of being as far away from the left-wing proposal as possible. And he can still come in with a $2 trillion bill or a $2.5 trillion bill and still be able to say, like, and look it, I stuck it to Bernie Sanders. And that's what Joe Manchin wants. And, you know, it's as if Bernie Sanders is the only Democrat who understands, who's ever, like, bought a car or, you know, like, negotiate for anything. Like, you know, like, Barack Obama used to do the exact opposite.
Right.
We're going to pre-negotiate with ourselves. And, you know, and Biden, on some level, was doing that. When he was doing it with the Republicans, he was doing that with Manchin. In other words, when he goes down to $1.2 trillion with the Republicans, he's signaling to Manchin, like, this is where I will be, and now you're going to have to move to the right of that number. But Sanders has made it now possible to say, like, well, here's the other ballast. And so, you know, you can be still on the side of restraint by coming in at $2.5 trillion. So that's very appreciative of that. All right. We started off the show by talking about Tucker Carlson backing off his assertion that it was FBI operatives who were leading the attack on the Capitol.
While pretending he wasn't backing off of it.
And just, I assert as a challenge that it's everybody else's job to figure this out. I'm just on the highest rated cable TV show in the country and have no resources to discover such things.
I'm just asking questions.
We spent more time figuring out where that thing we said in FedEx didn't show up to our offices in California than we did on this thing. Well, if only there was somebody who had the ability to vote in favor of, let's say, a commission, a bipartisan commission to look into this. And we could get these answers, these questions answered. Oh, I give you Louis Gohmert, who is convinced that the FBI may be involved in this, but I guess we can never know because we can't possibly have a commission to investigate it.
You know, so if there were federal agents that were involved on January 6th, we really need to know what the FBI knew and when they knew it. And not only that, we need to know how much participation did any of our federal friends, either at DOJ, FBI, or any of the intel community, what kind of role were they playing? Because there's information that came out about the effort to kidnap the Michigan governor, and there were federal agents. So it's been said there were federal agents that were involved in that.
Dude, you know, when you go on the House floor, you can't just kind of
wing it,
vaguely wing it, repeat what you heard on Tucker Carlson last night as you were kind of half asleep, dozing off in your leather armchair with like a glass of alcohol in your hand.
Oh, all right. Well, fortunately, I don't head to Congress too often.
It's just insane to me that we have these. Oh, sorry. We have these conversations as if the entirety of like the post 9/11 using Muslims as informants or entrapment, basically. Just no awareness that that happened.
No,
they're still doing it all the time.
All the time. Fort Dix 5 is the one that I always, you know, talk about. That story is incredibly compelling. But there's others where, you know, you have like guys, I think, in North Carolina who rolled up because they were going to take over the American government. They just were looking for uniforms and boots. That's what they needed. They were waiting on that. But also people in the environmental movement. I mean, this happens all the time. More than likely, what we have is not federal agents. We have more than likely people who became informants probably after the fact. There may have been some informants before the fact. I would hope that, that the FBI has, you know, at least some intelligence assets in some of like the more dangerous militias that are out there. But the bottom line is, you want to get to the bottom of this? There's a mechanism for that. Like, they're calling on, I don't know who it is that they're calling on, but that's the point, right? They don't want to know. They really don't want to know.
That's him smacking those lips.
All right, let's go through some IMs that we got to get out of here. Matthew from Minneapolis, 40 acres and a mule reversal strikes again as white conservative men want their free lollipop. COVID relief funds approved from the SBA targeted to minority and women-owned businesses are being halted and reversed after Tennessee and Texas courts claiming racism and sexism. I will look at that. I'll look at that stuff in a moment. Let's see what we got here. Important to note that roughly 21% of the U.S. Postal Service employees are African-American. Mega MCA. I haven't heard the longer Yang clip from the debate, but I think we can now call him Mommy Blog Karen Yang.
There's a longer clip in the segment that we posted yesterday.
Oh, there is? Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't see that. What was the nature of that?
Oh, did you hear what Yang said about homeless people?
Oh God.
He was essentially like, what was the exact quote? You know, we don't want to see them on our streets, you know. Essentially, he's proposing involuntary seizure of them and putting them in hospital beds, hospitalizing them against their will.
Homeless people have rights, but we have rights too.
Yes, mentally ill people have rights, but you know who else has rights? We do. And then he goes on, we have a right not to see them on our streets. We have a right to feel safe, etc. He leaned so hard into it, and he was like really impassioned about it as he said it. Oh, it was a bit.
I mean, when people like Yang do that stuff, though, it feels like a breath of fresh air to me. It's like, finally, we can just get this out in the open and treat it as like what it is, not have to like, you know.
Been awfully quiet, like compared to the days where we were taking a stance against Yang back in the primary, the presidential primary. It's much. I agree with Brendan. Like he is who we thought he was. It's an old sports quote from I think Denny Green.
Yeah, exactly.
The Bears are who that we thought we were. They were
Jimmy Dore. Hey, Emma, Matt, Brendan, don't tell Sam. But the first union meeting will be held Monday night outside of Joe's Pizza. Critical. Rice.
One. There's like seven of them.
And the Greenwich Village establishment.
You'll have to figure out yourself, guys.
They're very different. The taste in each location.
It's one of the problems with the unions. Bad, poor communication makes it very. critical rice theory. The perfect ratio of water to rice is 2:1. 2 cups of water to 1 cup of rice. As soon as you bring the water to a boil, turn it down to simmer for 15 minutes, and then turn the heat off entirely. That's pretty good. Perfect rice every time. Thank you. Stop the meal. If the government had all this info about the Trump supporters were set up, why didn't the Trump administration release it while they were still in power? It's always snowy in Ottawa. I don't know if you can play this for copyright reasons, but this video is basically what Tucker thinks the FBI did for January 6th. I don't know what this is. I don't know what it is. We'll have to play it another time. Shoot, I don't have the right.
Hey everyone, welcome to Forward. We are a new kind of doctor's office.
It's shoot, now I can't even get this thing off my, this ad stuff. Off me. Okay, there we go. Joe Rogan, Till, says, repeatedly cites the moment that hooked him into believing Alex Jones was Jones informing him of the fact law enforcement uses plants to crack down on protests. Greenwald and Carlson are now using this basic reality to make an argument we should opt into believing their assertion of a likelihood of FBI informants were involved in January 6th when no evidence of such information is yet to be presented. Classic Mott and Bailey argument. JC says, Greenwald defends Tucker for questioning his own network, says you would never hear Chris Hayes do that. Chris Hayes literally went on... was criticizing them about he does that all the time. I mean, he does that all the time, or not all the time, but in many major stories, he came out about I think issues with GE, came out about stuff with the sexual harassment stories. Mm-hmm. He came out with the union stuff, but Glenn has some very personal issues with people that have morphed into political positions. Aaron is not cool. Hey guys, I'm in Knoxville right now and no one is wearing a mask or social distancing. Very disorienting coming from NYC. It's been changing here pretty quickly too. Dummy Door is a doo-doo head who did a sexism to Anna Kay. When reporting on TYT, I feel it could also be correct to point out they've been engaging in union busting. Yeah, we did actually talk about that at the time when that story came out. We did cover it at the time. Ryan, don't be fooled by the obvious bait and switch IKEA DIY decor. I see through it and recognize the obvious NBC shill lies and constant head padding of coastal liberal elites. Love the show. Mr. Picklefeather, you look like someone drew a sad face on an expired onion. I think anyone would agree that you're the answer to the question, what if the phrase, that's what she said, had its own YouTube show? You obviously lost your above age 34, but the real over-under is, was it a mama? Oh, no, a mammal. Sorry. I love the show and want to ask you your opinion on Noam Chomsky's strong doubts about the Russiagate narrative. I personally think he's right to say it's overblown. We said it was overblown through the entire thing. That's the amazing thing about it. I mean, the closest we ever came to it, I think, and you can go back and listen to to the extent that we dedicated any interviews to it, we spoke to Marcy Wheeler at the time, who was giving us updates on the investigation. The investigation was real. It happened. You had the FBI, and then
there was interference, and it just was overblown.
There was interference, and I'm quite convinced, as I was during the contemporaneously, that there was a lot of relationships that had to do more with criminal activity than sort of like a political intrigue. Artie, Sam, I want to call in, please. I need to discuss Jimmy the Idiot Boar. That's going to have to wait till Monday.
Sorry.
Nolan from the Detroit suburbs. Hey, MR crew. The other day on Facebook, I saw a Twitter screenshot about a university offering senior discounted tuition. I was skeptical if it was true, so I verified the University of Minnesota offers tuition to qualified seniors for $10 per credit. Someone who's about $125,000 in student debt, it's very aggravating for me to see that and imagine that in another world, I wouldn't have to chase money to stay above water and I could pursue my PhD in physics. Kids these days. Sammy, I watched Bo Burnham's special Inside on Netflix. It's terrifying how constantly we offer ourselves up as content fodder for large corporations. They found a way to trick us into monitoring ourselves and freely giving away our most intimate desires and information. Really cool. Hypothetically, if S1 to pass as is, would this mansion Zoom conversation be illegal? And if so, what would be the penalties? Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I need to read into it more and know a little bit more about that Zoom call. But maybe. I mean, it sort of feels like it was technically illegal now. Mm-hmm. Like, you could argue he wasn't soliciting money, but he sort of...
Well, it wasn't on behalf of himself. That's what muddies it a little bit, but...
Special occasion sheets. Emma, early this week, the release date for the last King Killer book was added to Amazon next July. Not officially confirming, but we might finally get the ending.
I won't hold my breath. Luckily, I read the series fairly recently, so I haven't been waiting as long as everybody else.
MSNBC Cedar. Sam, I thought you were the president of MSNBC. I am the president of the section. The silo.
Right.
Midi Doctors. Sam, good show. Daily prompt. Remind everyone to hit the like button and subscribe. Poggers.
Yes.
A couple more. Why the F are Dems including a voter ID provision in the voting bill, says Louie. Are they so incompetent to not have thought of all the ways red states can simply change the laws to prevent you from getting an ID? Just the top of my head, abolish non-driver IDs. Create a new driver's license and invalidate all existing ones immediately. Deactivate driver's licenses if you haven't driven in a number of years. Change the identification proofs needed to get a license. Shut down DMVs.
Let's make the DMV more convoluted.
I mean, I think that's true, but I think the theory is this. It obviously drains resources from the Democrats to do this, but they have been successful. Outside organizations have been successful in using these voter ID laws as a motivation to draw out the vote. And some of the things that you say they can do, but it's also a little bit tougher to target. Like, you know, saying you can use a gun ID, but you can't use a college ID. That targets who's getting this. Mm-hmm. Shutting down DMVs in, you know, let's say... black communities or heavily Democratic areas, I don't think is quite as easy as you suggest it might be in terms of like the politics of it. Benny P, I just want to let you guys know this is the only political content I'm able to stomach these days. It's such a frustrating time to be a political junkie and see our policy priorities circling the drain and going nowhere. I just want you to know how much I appreciate the show and what you guys do every day. It keeps me sane. Sam, Emma, Matt, Brendan, Nomi, thank you. You have no idea how much this show means to so many people. Keep up the great work. That's very sweet. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
V, hey, can I get a shofar for my birthday? You guys are great. Left is best. And then Louis says, can I get a shofar for my Greek EU passport? All right. This is for both you guys. Chowder with Crowder. Sam, hypothetical. The majority report union makes a steep quality of life demand. What do you do? Fire everyone and cancel the show? Get a sixth the shirt. Is that the quality of life demand? Is that I get an extra shirt?
Guess so.
I don't know if anybody noticed, but I now have, like, you know, those blue shirts I have? I have a dark blue and a gray shirt.
I heard about the gray shirt.
The gray shirt was introduced late. And I'm going to get another one of these. I got one of these. I ordered one from Stitch Fix. the gray Heather one, but I didn't like it, so I sent it back. But I like the other blue one, but it's a stiff collar, so it's trouble. Glass-Steagall, the Supreme Court took another huge step in their project to make free exercise a bulletproof shield for white Christians to be open bigots. Make no mistake, if you're okay with the Fulton decision, you're okay with the country having second-class, third citizens, third-class citizens, without a doubt. Horrible. Will from Indiana, hey, I'm our crew. I forgot to mention my bumbling phone call on Tuesday. I'm now a member. Finally, tough job market and past semesters of college definitely held me back, but now it feels good to have an income and be able to contribute to the show. Door sucks. Left is best. Thank you, and you'll get one of these. And the final I am of the week. Denver Dave, I learned about Juneteenth in 1991 when I was in the Army. My sergeant major is black and from Texas, and my roommate is black and from Mississippi. And we all worked with many black people from East Texas, Louisiana, and the rest of the South. The U.S. Army was and still is not a progressive organization with the whole war and occupation thing. However, it is diverse and possesses many socialist elements. I am honored to have served with proud black comrades and thankful they have schooled me and shared Juneteenth celebration in Denver, Colorado. In addition, it took my barbecue and sweet potato pie baking skills to the next level. All right, folks, Matt, Emma, Brendan, great job this week. Folks, we will see you Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. Choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.